The preacher must not lecture. The best of lectures is very different to preaching. Very different indeed. Nevertheless, in my experience, lecturing is what much preaching seems to be these days. Moralistic lectures being the staple diet of most congregations. So ingrained is the notion that preaching is nothing but a religious reprimand or lecture, that in everyday life, to try to avoid being lectured by a friend, many would say, "Stop preaching to me. I don't need a sermon." Lloyd-Jones put his finger on the spot. In a lecture, you know what is happening. You are in control. But that is not the case when you are preaching. Suddenly, unexpectedly, this other element may break into a service. The touch of the power of the Spirit of God. So grievous did Philip Doddridge regard the practice of lecturing instead of preaching that he vowed, "I shall never affect to speak of the glories of Christ and of the eternal interests of man as coldly as if I were reading a lecture on mathematics or relating an experiment in natural philosophy. I would speak and write of the divine truths with a holy fervency." Lecturing. And a senior lecturer just below the rank of professor is called a reader. A reader. Ah. When talking about preaching, that word reader opens a can of worms. Let me have the courage, or the foolishness, to reach into the can, and in for a penny, in for a pound, take out one or two of those worms, things to be associated with reading. Namely, paper, computer printout, PowerPoint, and audio equipment. So important do I regard these matters, so dragging an effect do they have on real preaching, I must expand my remarks a little. Lecturing. Paper. Oh, if only we could get rid of all this paper, or at least most of it. Far too many sermons today taste of it, and taste of little else. In saying this, I know I am treading on the thinnest of thin ice, or, to change the figure, I know I am metaphorically taking my life in my hands for daring even to approach this sacred cow, let alone poke it with a stick. Nevertheless, I stand by what I have said. For a start, I hope I do not need to point it out, but in speaking against overloading the pulpit with paper, I am not saying a word against thorough preparation in private. But even then, the preparation of the man is far more important than the preparation of his script. In any case, that's not what I'm talking about. I am concerned here not with work before getting into the pulpit, but what the man does when he gets there. For preachers who do use more than the briefest of notes in the pulpit, I hope what I say may, at the very least, make them think about it. I know that those who do not agree with me have to answer to their own master, as I do, but I can only repeat that, in my experience, the preaching today, or at least the hearing of it, is being suffocated by computer printout. This is not the only source of our troubles, I admit, but it certainly has a deadening effect. Lloyd-Jones. We must give attention to something which may be a little more controversial. To me, there is a very special danger at this point, in reading as against preaching. Perhaps in the age in which we live, this is one of the greatest dangers of all. I know Lloyd-Jones was talking about the private reading of a book, as opposed to the actual hearing of a sermon preached, but I think the point he made is relevant to what I am saying. As he went on, we need to be brought under the power of the truth. We don't like it, but it's the business of the preacher to do that, and if he fails to do so, he is a very poor preacher. In any case, we have Lloyd-Jones' words directly on the subject. In general, the Puritans did not read their sermons, and quite often they did not have notes. It is interesting to observe that Calvin either preached from notes or in an entirely extempore manner. He did not read his sermons, and his preaching as a result was lively. Some of the early Baptists in this country not only did not believe in reading sermons or reciting them, after having read the scriptures, they would shut the Bible as they began to preach. Their view of preaching was that it was a kind of exhortation, something similar or comparable to the idea conveyed by prophecy in 1 Corinthians 14. The preaching of the Puritans was characterized by freedom, fervor, and passion. And I cannot but agree with Spurgeon. The best reading I have ever heard has tasted of paper and has stuck in my throat. I have not relished it, for my digestion is not good enough to dissolve foolscap. Lecturing. PowerPoint. Now for another shibboleth. And a shibboleth altogether more modern, but one that is already becoming more fashionable than paper. PowerPoint. Let me straight away put my foot in it. Like so much which goes on in today's church, we have aped the world with our PowerPoint presentations, our listing, visibly and strikingly, of bullet point facts. Bullet points? If ever there was a misnomer. I have said I am not alone in my worries about this modern phenomenon. The full title of T. David Gordon's book spells it out, Why Johnny Can't Preach. The media have shaped the messengers. He had something to say about PowerPoint. As did NASA. They found that when their advisor scientists predicted the risk to shuttle through a breakup of its foam protection, but did it by means of PowerPoint presentations, those very presentations clouded the warning they gave. So much so, no action was taken, and tragically, lives were lost. Those who have investigated the effect of such presentations have concluded that, as so often, the method seriously affects the message. Many wrongly think that more PowerPoint equates to better presentation. Take the love of PowerPoint lectures among university and college students. For all that, research has found that although students claim they like PowerPoint, not a few fail to complete the course or leave it worse informed. Researchers deduce that the speaker's argument and the audience thinking are, at the very least, seriously diminished by PowerPoint presentations. Why? The learning process becomes ritualistic. Arrows replace verbs. Relying upon bullets and one-liners, the presenter does not argue his case. Bullets remove or mask the relative weight and nuances of what he is trying to say. Witness the shuttle disaster already mentioned. The method encourages a love of alliteration. The presentation becoming yet again more important than the message, style more important than content. Furthermore, whereas when addressing an audience, the speaker should speak directly to the people, make pointed contact with them, having direct communication with them, arousing curiosity as opposed to spoon-feeding them, raising questions and debate, convincing his hearers by a spectrum of argument and illustration. With PowerPoint, the presenter displays his material on the screen, comes to an end of what he has prepared, literally switches off to leave a blank screen or a clever screensaver as he quits the rostrum. Instead of encouraging the audience to think, he has made his hearers marvel at or be frustrated by the technology. In short, the presenter and his equipment become more important than the audience. Indeed, in my experience, more important than the business we have met for. The means has taken over from the end. While it's true that researchers have found that PowerPoint makes a poor speaker into a mediocre one, the overall effect is bad. All this is heightened when it comes to preaching. The preacher becomes a presenter, not a preacher. The congregation is dulled. Both preacher and hearer concentrate on the screen. He should concentrate on them, and they should concentrate on him. And both should concentrate on the gospel, on Christ. both he and they look at the screen, when he should be looking at them, and they should be looking at him. PowerPoint ruins this. Both preacher and congregation are robbed of what they are supposed to have gathered for. As I have said, the means takes over from the end. I think it's fair to say that, far from being a handmaid, PowerPoint dominates the service. For instance, I have known a service delayed while a group of men at the front, bending over the equipment, fiddle with the laptop, mouse, PC leads, screen projector, and all the rest. I don't want to be silly, but imagine such a group carrying on like that while, say, the Queen was waiting. After all, our services are supposed to be to do with and before God, aren't they? And all this fiddling, for what? For a method which in itself robs the speaker of charisma, or at the very least, masks it. Again, in my experience, many advocates of PowerPoint simply do not know how to use it. My lasting impression is of a preacher vainly wagging his zapper at the screen, not the laptop, desperately trying to recover the right window. But I throw in the towel. PowerPoint is here to stay, I am afraid. Children are taught by it, and increasingly have to use it in school, and become proficient in handling it. And how common it has become in politics and political meetings. As for the business and the medical world, I cannot speak, but I can guess. Nevertheless, I am unrepentant. Although PowerPoint may well have its uses, its overall effect on preaching will be detrimental, to put it mildly. Even if 90% of what I have said on this subject strikes you as logistical rubbish, the overall effect of the use of PowerPoint in the pulpit is something worth thinking about, isn't it? May I suggest that we get a grip on the biblical principles of preaching before we let those clever young whiz kids from Microsoft or Apple sweep us completely off our feet? So much for my remarks on the current trend to use paper and PowerPoint in the pulpit. The two are not unconnected, of course. The increasing tendency, helped no doubt by the overweening facility of the PC, to take a sheaf of paper, with or without the laptop PowerPoint, into the pulpit is killing real preaching. I am no Luddite. Anything which furthers real preaching, even though it has been invented these past 5 minutes, is excellent. Let's use it. But anything new or old which stifles real preaching must be poleaxed. Leave the world to use worldly techniques to peddle its wares. They do it better. In any case, that's all they've got. We, after all, claim to have the Spirit. Of course, it's altogether too easy to cut and paste and print off a few more sheets these days, or to spend hours editing a manuscript, changing fonts, centralizing text, fine-tuning those clever visual fireworks and the like. But I doubt the angels rejoice over another PowerPoint presentation, which has been titivated to make it even more spectacularly professional. I have witnessed at first hand how a preacher and his wife can waste a good part of Saturday on the PC tweaking the presentation of his next day's discourse. Pointless and worse. I cannot see the devils having many sleepless nights over it. I rather suspect they might be behind it. I fear also that a growing number of preachers, conscious of the recording apparatus, conscious of the internet, conscious of their reputation, read their fully prepared sermons so as to avoid any gaffes. In some cases, it is obvious that someone has sanitized the recordings before release. The effect is to leave the end product even more stifling and unreal. And now a word or two on the ubiquitous and obligatory audio equipment. Lecturing. Audio equipment. Even the smallest meeting house nowadays seems to need the most sophisticated audio equipment. While I recognize the invaluable benefit of the loop system to the hard of hearing, could this not be accomplished without the bewildering array of electronics, seemingly a necessity in the smallest meeting rooms these days? For this too stifles real preaching. How can a man lift up his voice if the audio system blasts the eardrums of his hearers? Speaking for myself, since I am almost invariably hemmed in and coffined, to coin a word, by an imposing pulpit and a barrage of electrical equipment, I quite often inadvertently knock into the microphone as my... Sorry about this. Speaking for myself, since I am almost invariably hemmed in and coffined, to coin a word, by an imposing pulpit and a barrage of electrical equipment, I quite often inadvertently knock into the microphone as I move my arms and hands. What is more, the audio equipment, if it influences the preacher and he adapts to it, can only tend to produce a confidential fireside chat from the pulpit, not preaching. Spurgeon would stuff his handkerchief into the equivalent apparatus of his day. When his hearers found no sound coming out of their end of the contraption, they would put the receiver down, to find they could hear perfectly well without it. I recently preached with two microphones, an old-fashioned article dominating the desk, and a fairly modern radio version, complete with dangling lead, attached to my clothes. During the last hymn, I noticed that the real microphone had been switched off throughout the service. Nobody had noticed. Nobody complained. In fact, when I pointed out what had happened, I was told it was all perfectly okay. For all this growing dependence on electrical apparatus, PowerPoint and audio, perhaps I might suggest the litmus test. What would happen in your church if there was a power failure? Could the service go on? How would the preacher manage? Could you sing any hymns or songs? Could the preacher preach? Let me now get back to the main theme of this section. Lecturing, with or without the tyranny of paper, PowerPoint, or audio equipment. These things, I say, though many consider them helps, in fact, too often, dominate the proceedings, and to their detriment. Imagine an actor carrying his script onto the stage, his eyes fixed to the paper. Where would his power be? It would evaporate. Picture the scene. Henry V, addressing his men at Harfleur, before going into battle against the French. The king carrying his computer printout, or clutching his mouse or zapper, while pointing to the screen. I ask you, once more unto the breach, dear friends, or close the wall up with our English dead. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath and bend up every spirit to its full height. On, you noblest English, and teach them how to war. And you, good yeoman, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the mettle of your pasture. For there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble lustre in your eyes. I see you. Stand. Like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game is afoot. Follow your spirit, and upon this charge cry God for Harry, England, and St. George. Imagine it. Can you see Laurence Olivier glancing down, peering every other line at the flapping script in his hand, or fixing his gaze on the giant screen, zapper in hand? Just a moment, he cries, while I get the right window. The idea is laughable. How much more so for the preacher of the gospel, pleading with sinners, pleading with them, not to fight the French, but to come to Christ. In November 2010, the Royal Shakespeare Company opened its refurbished theatre. They had done away with the old framed stage and replaced it with a platform that projects into the auditorium. No one is now more than a few meters from the action. A lady speaking on behalf of the theatre explained. In effect, she said, we want the actors to breathe the same air as the audience, not have them perform in a separate space cut off by the proscenium arch. Quite. Leaving aside actors, what about the example of the prophets, John the Baptist, Christ and the Apostles? Is there any record, any hint of a whiff of a suggestion that they carried a sheaf of notes with them? Of course, I am not so daft as to think that paper had been invented in those days, let alone the PC with its printout. But they certainly had writing paraphernalia, which they used at the appropriate time. But where did we come across any suggestion that such prophetical preachers did anything but address the people freely, with arms and hands stretched out, body on the move? Can you imagine Peter in Acts 2, 3, or 10? Or Paul in Acts 13, 16, 17, or 26, for instance, fumbling with notes as they address the people? How can a man stretch out his hands when he clasps a sheaf of paper or fiddles with it on the desk? Is any power lost if the preacher does stretch out his hands to the congregation, zapper to the fore? But I abandon ship. The only solution is to go the whole hog and be thoroughly professional. Shoestring and PowerPoint are odd bedfellows. Get a proper IT suite hidden away. Have a body of professional technicians. Plan the service, marking the script at every point with appropriate directions for the staff, and make it all seamless. Go on a course for film producers and directors. Get a PhD in media studies. Get it sorted. Seamless and professional it will be, but I am afraid that is all. By the way, I saw a DVD of an evangelical stroke reformed conference which gave the game away. Owing to bad weather, the meeting could not be held in the usual venue. Instead, the preacher declaimed in a cramped studio, and the link was beamed to various reception centres. The point is, the studio being so cramped, we could see that which is normally hidden from view. Namely, the various technicians and producers, script in hand, surrounded by TV screens, all poised to fill their slot in the presentation at each relevant point in the script. What would have happened if the Spirit had broken into the meeting, one can only imagine. Don't we like spontaneity any more? I do. Like it. Wait a minute. What about Jonathan Edwards? Didn't he read his sermons, and painstakingly so? Well, actually, no. He did not. Myth does not turn into truth merely by repetition. Ian Murray's conclusion was that Edwards came to be more fully convinced, as Grandfather Stoddard had been long before, that freedom from dependence on a manuscript was in best accord with the true nature of preaching. In his later ministry, at least, Edwards would have agreed with Alexander Grosart, who asserts that the practice of reading sermons, except in rare instances, quenches all real eloquence and breaks the spell of influence which ought to bind a speaker and his audience. Note Murray's reference to Edwards' grandfather, Solomon Stoddard. Well, we know what he thought of a preacher using notes. In 1723, he preached a sermon, The Defects of Preachers Reproved, in which he said, question, is the late practice of some ministers in reading their sermons commendable? Answer, ordinarily it is not to be allowed. Consideration one. It was not the manner of the prophets or apostles. Barak read the roll that was written from the mouth of Jeremiah, but Jeremiah was not wont to read his prophecies. It was the manner of the Jews to read the scriptures in the synagogues, but after that it was their way to instruct and exhort men, not from any written copy. Acts 13:15. After the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them, saying, men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on. This was according to the example of Christ. It was ordered in England in the days of King Edward VI that ministers should read printed homilies in public, and there was great necessity of it, for there was not one in ten who were able to make sermons, but it has been the manner of worthy men both here and in other places to deliver their sermons without their notes. Consideration two. The reading of sermons is a dull way of preaching. Sermons, when read, are not delivered with authority and in an affecting way. When sermons are delivered without notes, the looks and gesture of the minister are a great means to command attention and stir up affection. Men are apt to be drowsy in hearing the word, and the liveliness of the preacher is a means to stir up the attention of the hearers and beget suitable affection in them. Sermons that are read are not delivered with authority. They favour, that is, They resemble, smack of, the sermons of the scribes. Experience shows that sermons read are not so profitable as others. It may be argued that it's harder to remember rhetorical sermons than mere rational discourses, but it may be answered that it is far more profitable to preach in the demonstration of the Spirit than with the enticing words of man's wisdom. See the reason why there is so little effect of preaching. There is a great fault in hearers. They are not studious of the mind of God. They are enemies to the gospel. And when Christ himself preached among them, many did not profit by it. Yet some preachers are much to blame. Hence it is that there is so little conversion. There is great complaint in one country and in another that there are few converted. It is apparent by men's unsanctified lives and their unsavory discourses. This is one reason. There is a great deal of preaching that does not much promote it, but is a hindrance to it, to tell men that they may be converted, though they don't know the time, and that faith is nothing else but a persuasion that the gospel is true, is the very way to make many carnal men hope that they are converted. It makes other preaching very ineffectual. It makes them think that it is needless to strive for conversion. Such preaching hardens men in their sins. The want of dealing plainly with men is the reason why there is seldom a noise among the dry bones. In some towns, there is no such thing to be observed for 20 years together, and men continue in a senseless condition, come to meetings and hear preaching, but are never the better for it. In some towns, godly men are very thinly sown. Most of the people are in as bad a condition as if they had never heard the gospel. They go on in a still, that is, calm, undisturbed way, following their worldly designs, carrying on somewhat of the form of godliness, but mind little but the world and the pleasures of this life. The scribes did not preach with authority. Matthew 7:29, and they entered not into the kingdom of God themselves, and they that were entering in they hindered. Such preaching is not mighty to the pulling down of strongholds. Conversion work will fail very much where there is not sound preaching. If Stoddard could say that of New England in 1723, what would he say of us today in the UK or the USA? By the way, Stoddard's effort in the above extract encourages me, at least, to think that I have not done anything wrong in speaking out on this subject. Moreover, whoever has or has not used a sheaf of notes when preaching, I still say the pulpit today is choked with paper. I further say that the paper and the preacher's dependence on it in delivering his moral lecture is obvious to those of us who sit in the pew. And I, for one, do not like it. Paper does not touch me. I want power, not paper. If paper is so important to the preacher, and he without it apparently cannot remember what he is going to say, or it is not sufficiently burned into his heart, how am I and the rest of my fellow hearers expected to remember what he has said? If the paper is so important, why not simply give us the paper and let us all go home? Why are we bothering to go through the rigmarole of hearing a preacher read his lecture? And what of the system in which the preacher gives out his paper as well as repeats it from the pulpit? Come to think of it, a bit like church notices these days. More belt and braces, I suppose. Why not go the whole hog and give everybody a CD, DVD, or MP3 of the lecture as well, belt, braces, and string? I dare say preachers adopt this way for fear of making a mistake. A mistake? What mistake? Getting his points slightly adrift? Muddling up a bit of grammar? Who cares? Christ and Paul had their anacoluthans. To avoid such trivial offences today, we're having to suffer the greater offence of being bored. What is more, speaking for myself, I simply cannot take in the lecture when it comes over in such a polished, concentrated form. I need the ums and ahs, the little hesitations, corrections, and repetitions. They help me to keep up. Having got those two gripes off my chest, I must not let my frustration further stop me getting on with the theme of this section. Preaching is not lecturing. That is my point. Lloyd-Jones. Preaching a sermon is not to be confused with giving a lecture. A lecture lacks and should lack the element of attack, the concern to do something to the listener, which is a vital element in preaching. Attack? That's the very word. But shouldn't the preacher be correct? Yes, of course. But he should have sorted out the correctness of his exposition long before he got into the pulpit. When there, his chief concern should be confrontation, attack, life. We must have life in the pulpit, not mere correctness, life. I recall a conversation with a classical guitarist who was comparing two virtuosi. One, he told me, was more nearly note perfect, but the other had more life. Life, warmth, expression, that is what we need. Light, of course we must have light. Of course we need accuracy, but we want heat as well. Two men preached. After the first had finished, an old preacher sitting beside Lloyd-Jones summed it up. Light without heat. Then came the second man. After he had sat down, the old preacher spoke again. Heat without light. Lloyd-Jones, quoting this, gave his conclusion. Both preachers were defective. What is preaching? Logic on fire. Eloquent reason. John Angel James. There must not only be the directive, that is the instructive, but the impulsive, that is the impelling, compelling manner. Our great business is to persuade, to entreat, to beseech. We have to deal with a dead, heavy resistance of mind. Indeed, more, we have to overcome a stout resistance and to move a reluctant heart. If all that was necessary to secure the ends of our ministry were to lay the truth open to the mind, if the heart was already predisposed to the subject of our preaching, then, like the lecturer on science, we might dispense with the hortatory, that is, the urging manner, and confine ourselves exclusively to explanation. Logic would suffice. But when we find in every sinner we address an individual acting in opposition to the warnings of his conscience, as well as to the testimony of Scripture, an individual is sacrificing the interests of his immortal soul to the vanities of the world and the corruptions of his heart, an individual who is madly bent upon his ruin and rushing to the precipice, for which he will take his final leap into perdition. Can we be satisfied with merely explaining, however clearly, and demonstrating, however conclusively, the truth of revelation? James illustrated his point by the effort required to stop a suicidal man carrying out his dreadful intention. Would exegesis, however clear and accurate, be enough in this case? Should we not lay hold of the arm uplifted for self-destruction and snatch the poison cup from the hand? What is the case with unrepentant sinners to whom we preach, if not indeed the present destruction of their bodies, but of their souls? There they are before our eyes, rushing in their sins and their unrepentance to the precipice that overhangs the pit of destruction. And how shall we content ourselves with sermons, however excellent for elegance, for logic, for perspicuity, and even for evangelism, but have no urging power, no moving tendency, none of the apostles' beseeching entreaty of 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20. Shall we merely lecture on theology and deal out religious science to men who, amidst a flood of light already pouring over them and blazing around them, care for none of these things? If the answer is not self-evident, there is no hope for us. Light and heat. Let us take some advice from the early 1600s. Old advice it may be, but still good, from John Smith. I purpose to apply my style to the understanding of the simple. I endeavour to utter matter with all plainness of words and sentences. That is what I mean by light. Communicating with the people. As John Clifford, 250 years later, commenting on Spurgeon, put it, where others appealed to taste and fancy, imagination or reason. He sought to commend himself to every man's conscience in the sight of God. Instead of force and stilted dignity, pointless speech and icy coldness, he introduced natural manners, frank talk, and warm human sympathy. He got rid of the pulpit, and the change from the pulpit to the platform was a typical illustration of the freedom and homeliness, directness and humaneness, as he sent into the ministry, of these latter times. On April the 24th, 1855, Spurgeon wrote to the editor of a Chelmsford newspaper, thanking him for an article in the paper. Spurgeon explained that it was unusual for him to comment on such, but since this was a rare piece of praise, he felt it right to thank the editor. In the course of his letter, he explained his philosophy. "I am perhaps vulgar and so on, but it is not intentional, save that I must and will make the people listen. My firm conviction is that we have had quite enough polite preachers, and that the many require a change." Let me take another example from the 1600s. Thomas Hooker noticed that many hearers, as he put it, go away so well contented after hearing the laudium preachers. Such preachers, preaching above the heads, let alone the hearts, of the majority of their hearers, using Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, quoting the fathers and whatnot, still received their hearers' accolade. Why? "The reason," it says Hooker, "because all this stings not, and they, the hearers, may sit and sleep in their sins and go to hell hoodwinked." Carl Brittenbaugh put it succinctly. In contrast to the laudium preachers, the plain preachers shot their arrows directly into the hearts of their listeners. Let me hazard a guess and adjust that statement somewhat. The flowery preachers didn't take any arrows with them in the pulpit, since they didn't think shooting was their job. I doubt they even had a bow. Display was what they and their hearers wanted, and that is what the preachers provided, and that is what the hearers got. It is nothing new. Pulpit and pew feed off each other and reinforce each other. See Jeremiah 5, verse 31. All this is taking me to the question of warmth. Warmth, heat. Once when Simeon Ash was appointed to preach, Hooker was in the congregation. "Sim," said Hooker, "let it be hot." Or as a hearer of John Rogers, one of the awakening preachers said, "Come, let's go to Dedham and get a little warmth." Although John Berridge's words, when in his usual quaint way, putting it thus in advising a fellow preacher, could be misused, he was making a vital point. "The more I think about my sermons, the less liberty and power I have in preaching. Be not anxious to lay in a stock beforehand for the pulpit. It should be given you in the hour. Hot bread from the oven and roast meat from the spit are better by far than old cooked victuals from the pantry." Lecturing, reading a paper, away with it. Overloading the grate with paper puts a fire out. Spurgeon spoke of the stifling of zeal when buried beneath learning and paper. Many a man who, in his aspirations to be literary, has rather qualified himself to write reviews than to preach sermons. Christ hung be crucified beneath Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. It was said of Lloyd-Jones that he was primarily a preacher and wished to remain so. To safeguard his persuasive speaking gift and main strength, he resisted numerous pressing invitations with admirers and publishers to write. This he regarded as quite a different gift, the use of which could easily spoil the particular ability of a preacher. Why is this? Because the art of writing is generally different to the art of speaking. Because to take a sheaf of paper into the pulpit shows that a man is concerned with the text and accuracy. What's wrong with that? Nothing in itself. Indeed, it's highly commendable. But the preacher must be concerned above all with the people in front of him. The people, not his paper, not his notes. If he concentrates on his paper, any semblance of fire will die, and fire we must have. Lloyd-Jones's comments on the bad effect of writing make interesting reading. I suggest that another factor has been the wrong conception of what a sermon really is, and therefore of what preaching really is. I believe that the printing and publication of sermons has had a bad effect upon preaching. I refer particularly to the publication of sermons, roughly speaking, since somewhere about 1890, and dare I say it, I have a feeling that the Scottish school of preachers have been the greatest offenders in this respect. I believe it happened in this way. These men were endowed with a real literary gift, and the emphasis passed unconsciously again from the truth of the message to the literary expression. They paid great attention to literary and historical allusions and quotations and so on. In other words, these men were essayists rather than preachers. But as they published these essays as sermons, they were accepted as sermons. That has undoubtedly had a controlling effect upon the thinking of many in the church as to what a sermon should be, and also as to what preaching really is. So I would attribute a good deal of the decline in preaching at the present time to those literary effusions which have passed under the name of sermons and of preaching. The result of all these things has been that a new idea has crept in with regard to preaching, and it's taken various forms. A most significant one was that people began to talk about the address in the service instead of the sermon. That in itself was indicative of a subtle change. An address. No longer the sermon, but an address. Or perhaps even a lecture. S.D. Gordon published a series of books under the significant title of Quiet Talks. Quiet Talks, you see, as against the ranting of the preachers. Quiet Talks on prayer. Quiet Talks on power, etc. In other words, the very title announces that the man is not going to preach. Preaching, of course, is something carnal, lacking in spirituality. What is needed is a chat, a fireside chat, quiet talks, and so on. That idea came in. Lloyd-Jones commented on a sermon he heard on Jeremiah's fire in his bones. I left the service feeling that I had witnessed something quite extraordinary. For the one thing that was entirely missing from the service was fire. The good man was talking about fire as if he were sitting on an iceberg. He was actually dealing with the theme of fire in a detached and cold manner. He was a living denial of the very thing he was saying. Or perhaps I should say, a dead denial. It was a good sermon from the standpoint of construction and preparation. He'd obviously taken considerable care over this, and obviously, did Lloyd-Jones deliberately repeat the obviously, written out every word, because he was reading it. But the one thing that was absent was fire. There was no zeal, no enthusiasm, no apparent concern for us as members of the congregation. His whole attitude seemed to be detached and academic and formal. And that just about sums up a good many sermons today. Light we must have, but warmth we cannot do without. I recall a sermon I endured on Acts 3 and 4. I make no comment on the exegesis. That may have been excellent. I can't remember. But what I do remember is that the man declaimed in such a sleepy way, he conveyed to me, at least, the exact opposite impression of the fireworks so evident in the passage he was supposed to be pressing upon our hearts. And that leads me to the next point. Earnestness.